Welcome to The Story Voice, a podcast of stories from great storytellers. I am Mary Edgerton, your host for this episode. My guest today is a special person with some truly out-of-this-world experiences to share with us. Don't worry, once we are finished, I will bring you all back to Earth and you will feel better for the experience. Enriched in knowledge, we are all members of the human race. My storyteller today is Jerry Miller. Jerry currently works with the Harris County Public Health Department and actually has been very busy during the pandemic. But prior to that, he was a flight controller for Mission Control at NASA, where his specialty was extravehicular activity, commonly known to us as spacewalks. Jerry, can you tell us one of your favorite stories about a mission?
Oh, gosh. Thanks, Mary. And I appreciate being here. Oh, there were a lot of missions, but I have to say probably the most interesting one, at least for me, was back in 92, a mission called STS-49. There had been a communication satellite called Intelsat 6, which had been launched on board a French rocket by a company called Ariane. And being a communication satellite, it was to be stationed 27,000 miles out at geosynchronous orbit. And those kinds of satellites get launched kind of in two phases. The primary rocket, in this case from Ariane, has a shroud. And inside the shroud, there's the satellite and a second stage booster that are mated together. So the primary rocket goes up and the shroud opens. And then the second stage fires and pushes the satellite all the way out to 27,000 miles. And then a command is issued and the satellite separates from the second stage. Well, unfortunately for Ariane, there was a bit of a wiring problem. And so the primary rocket went up, the shroud opened, then the command was issued. So the satellite separated from the second stage. And only at that point did the second stage fire. So it went blithely on its way without a satellite. And what we were left with is a perfectly good satellite in a perfectly useless orbit. So Ariane came to NASA and said, what can be done? And a lot of different options were looked at. Some folks were saying, well, could you just go and get it and bring it back and then we'll launch it again? And we said, well, you know, that's going to be twice the number of launches you need. We said, why don't we bring a new second stage up with us and we can capture the satellite on orbit, put it together with a new second stage and send it on its way. So that's what we decided to do. Now, unfortunately, this is just a communication satellite. Of course, it's unmanned and it was launched on an unmanned rocket. So this thing was just never meant to be touched by people, certainly not people in big, clunky, pressurized spacesuit gloves. And so we had to be very careful with how we handled it. That basically was shaped like a great big 12,000-pound coffee can. And the entire outside was glass because it was solar cells. And so we couldn't touch it anywhere on the sides. There was just a small ring around the bottom, which is where you actually mated the second stage to. So we came up with a thing called a capture bar. It's kind of a long bar with jaws on it and kind of a steering wheel in the middle. And in the end was a grapple fixture for the robotic arm. And the plan was to put a crew member in a spacesuit in a foot restraint on the robotic arm and just lift the robotic arm up with the crew member underneath this satellite with the capture bar. And we would set it up there and the jaws would clamp on that ring. Then the robotic arm would grab the grapple fixture and bring it down, which is a good plan. And it's a great approach. And it took a lot of planning and timing and training. And, you know, just even before the mission effort started, the stress levels started climbing up because the mission had been insured by Lloyd's of London. So as we were going through the planning and the training, I literally had Lloyd's of London representatives, one standing over each shoulder in the water tank as we were performing the practice and the timelining of getting this right. So the stress level was already pretty good. And the day came for us to do it on orbit. And we went out, and as probably most people are familiar, when you're in microgravity, when you're in space, things are quote unquote weightless. Well, what it really means is that it doesn't take much in the way of force to tap it, and you start getting motion that you don't want. And that's what we knew we would encounter. And unfortunately, it's exactly what we saw when we got on orbit. We went the first day, two people in a spacewalk out to put the capture bar in place. And every time we would get close, just the slightest touch and the satellite would start to tumble. It had to be corrected. We went back. We did that all one day, couldn't get the job done. We went back the next day, we stood down, came back the next day, went out on another spacewalk, had the same results. So we stood down and we replanned something that had never been done before. In fact, it's never been done since, which is to send three people out on a spacewalk at one time. It's never been done by the US, it's never been done by the Russians. There are a lot of challenges. It may kind of sound easy enough from the outside, but the fact is the spacesuits, the airlocks, all of the support systems for doing a spacewalk are really only set up to do it with two people. So doing it with three was quite a challenge just in and of itself. And the way that we came up with to do a workaround to get a hold of the satellite was we positioned a crew member on each side of the payload bay of the shuttle. And we put the third member in a foot restraint on that robotic arm. So basically we formed a triangle, and the commander, with a lot of really fancy flying, flew the space shuttle up underneath the satellite. And literally on the count of three, the crew members in these big clunky pressurized gloves reached up and very delicately grabbed the edge of this glass ring around the edge of the satellite so that we could hold it in place while we connected that capture bar manually, and then let the robotic arm bring it down, got it onto the cradle, bolted the new second stage on, and chucked it overboard and sent it on its way. What was really fun, not only was that the first and only three-person spacewalk, but at the end of it, we had at that time set a new world record for the longest spacewalk. It was 8 hours and 29 minutes.
Wow, it took that long to actually, well, I guess to try and try and try again sometimes. It's pretty.
Right.
That's amazing. Boy, when I fly, I'd like to fly whoever was flying that shuttle.
Dan Brandenstein, that was the commander. Some very fancy flying that day.
So, you know, that had to be very stressful. You know, you have people's lives in your hands, you have Lloyd's of London behind you, any touch is a problem. So what would you do to like calm down when you went home at the end of the day? How would you relax?
You know, Mary, that is a really loaded question for this particular mission. It's interesting that you would ask that, because you know the old adage that sometimes the most interesting show is the one going on backstage. Well, to be honest with you, that's very much the way this mission was. Unbeknownst to anyone in our mission operations management or any of my team, at home I was dealing with a equally stressful situation. If I recall, we launched, I believe it was a Thursday. And then the whole week leading up to that, things were happening that were extraordinarily stressful. My sister-in-law had the very, very unfortunate news the previous Tuesday that the baby she was carrying was sadly a severe victim of spina bifida, and the fetus was not viable, and that very sadly, they were going to need to terminate the pregnancy, which was very difficult. We had dispensation from the Vatican due to the circumstance, and the pregnancy had to be terminated on a Saturday. The next Monday, 2 days later, my father-in-law died of a heart attack. So compounding the stress of the pregnancy with now the death of my father-in-law and the mission getting ready to launch in a few days, things were very difficult dealing with stress at home. And just when we thought it was not going to get worse, it did. My father-in-law's remaining brother passed away. And then we were planning the funeral for my father-in-law the day that his brother passed away. And we held the funeral on Wednesday, which was the day before launch. I literally had to leave the funeral early in order to start sleep shifting for this mission. And when I got home, this was back in the days of answering machines, there were messages on the machine already that my family had come back from Huntsville where the funeral was and actually beaten me home because my father-in-law's sister, who had been at her brother's funeral, came home to discover that her husband had committed suicide during the funeral. So my family was now home dealing with that situation. And we were getting ready to launch within hours. I wasn't able to share any of what I was dealing with at home with anyone in the mission management team, because at that time, I really wasn't allowed to explain any of what was going on in my home life and my in-laws, since I am married to a person who is also a man. And the added stress of the family situation, not being able to tell anyone because I couldn't be out about it, was then, of course, compounded with this mission that just kind of blew up in everybody's faces.
Yeah, that just really sounds terrible. You know, and it sounds terrible that as a society, we had such prejudices against people who love whom they love. So how did you finally come out to NASA? And how was this a rule in NASA or?
No, you know, Mary, it certainly wasn't a written rule, but it was unfortunate that there was a very influential individual in mission management who had once very famously quoted, and I apologize to anyone offended, but made the quote that there would never be a faggot in his front room. Of course, unbeknownst to this individual, I certainly wasn't the only one, but he was very much dependent on one to save this mission. And it wasn't long after that I was kind of doing my side gig, which is acting. And I was portraying Alan Turing in a production of Breaking the Code. And for any of your listeners who are familiar with him, brilliant, brilliant mathematician who set the foundation for modern computing, and essentially saved the Allies in the North Atlantic during World War II by breaking the German Enigma code, but was unfortunately then persecuted by his own country when they discovered the fact that he was gay. So as I was portraying Alan Turing, I found myself really thinking, you know, I can't do this person justice, knowing that I'm keeping quiet to keep people where I work in the dark about things. Certainly, I'm no Alan Turing, I don't mean that, but I've certainly done my best and I've done a lot of good things on behalf of my country. I just didn't feel right portraying this man. So I brought my NASA management in one day and said, I need to speak with you about something. And things were pretty tense. And I thought, well, okay, this is just not going to go well at all. But I explained to them, this is a circumstance. It's not something I'm going to hide any longer. And they had the most interesting reaction because they said, oh, thank God. I said, well, okay, I didn't really expect that, but what do you mean? And they said, oh, we thought you called us in here to quit. They said, it's fine if you're gay, just please don't leave.
Now that had to be somewhat reassuring, you know, especially after this previous person had created a different atmosphere, to have them say, oh, thank God you're not leaving.
Yeah, right. It was very reassuring. And, you know, it was very interesting to have become the first openly gay flight controller in Mission Control.
That's great. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
That's a very honorable and brave thing to do.
Oh, thank you.
So, Jerry, has your life calmed down? I realize you're working in the pandemic, and that is not a calm situation, but did your life kind of settle down after that? Were you able to get into cruise control for a while?
Well, you know, it would have been nice, I suppose. Not long after that, we started the Shuttle Mir program, where we were flying the space shuttle up to the Russian space station. And I became part of the team that traveled back and forth to Russia. And I did that for a number of years. And it was an experience that I wouldn't trade for anything, particularly, you know, being a child who grew up during the Cold War. I was in places and doing things with people that I never dreamed that I would be. And it's an experience I will never, ever, would ever want to have traded off. Although I have to say, Mary, there was one experience there that I would have been happy to trade. I guess I could tell you about the time I was very nearly kidnapped by the Russian mafia. How about that?
Oh my God. You know,
yeah. We lived, those of us on the NASA team, we lived in a very nice apartment building called the Volga. And it was in a very nice area of town. But in this same nice area of town, it was also very common to see members of the Russian mafia, because they liked the nice area of town too. And you would see them in their long black stretch Mercedes and the gentlemen in the suits with the guns and things like that. And it just was pretty common. And one day I was getting ready actually to take a trip back to the US. And so I hadn't been at work that day. I'd been packing up and things in my apartment. And I hadn't shaved. I was looking pretty scruffy. And a friend of mine, a Russian friend of mine, said, hey, I bought you this book. I want to give you as a souvenir. But I'm on the metro on the way home. Run over to the metro stop and I'll give you the book before you go. And I said, okay, sure. So I threw on a baseball cap and a sweatshirt and I went running to try to meet the metro train. And interestingly enough, on the street, as I ran by, there was one of these big black mafia Mercedes, but the windshield was completely smashed out on it. And I literally thought, wow, that's unfortunate for someone. That's because those bosses, they're not going to take real well to having their little prized Mercedes destroyed. But as I ran by and thinking this, I felt this vice grip of two really big arms grab me and whirl me around. And, you know, standing there in front of me was every textbook definition of a large mafia henchman. He was very big and very burly and in the suit. And as he whipped me around and his coat open, there was the gun in the shoulder holster and everything. And he began just railing at me in Russian about, you know, I've got you now. This had to have been you. You're running from the scene, and you know, I'm taking you back to my boss, and you're going to pay for this, boy. You've had it, and you know, well, we've all had those experiences. You know, it is only a millisecond or two, but in your brain, there's this 2-hour conversation going on,
right?
Yeah, and all I could think was, you know, first and foremost, the last thing you want is to be carted away by this man, because they will find pieces of you in the Moscow River. And so I knew I had to throw him off somehow. So the only thing that occurred to me was, oh, I'll just get as irate as he is, but I'll do it in English. So in English, I started ranting and raving about, you know, I don't know what your problem is. I had nothing to do with this. I live over here. And you know, it that did throw him, because he looked he looked a little perplexed. He wasn't sure what to make of it because he knew full well, you know, Americans aren't going to the expense of traveling all the way to Russia just to be a punk who breaks windows, you know. So he wasn't sure quite what to make of it, but he wasn't completely sure either. So he calmed down a little bit, but he said, well, you know, I don't care who you are, but, you know, I know what I'll do. I'm going to keep you here until the police come. I'm going to have the police show up. And of course, not to sound like a bad movie, but the fact is, you know, Mary, that probably the only people worse than the mob that you want to be taken away by would be the Moscow police, quite honestly. And so I said, I switched to Russian and I said, no, that's not what I'm going to do. I explained to him in Russian, I live right there. Please go over and talk to the concierge. They'll confirm for you who I am. I said, I'm not going to wait with you. I'm not going anywhere with you. I'm going to go on my way. And I kind of took a deep breath and I turned and I thought, okay, don't run. Cause like a dog, they're going to chase you, you know? And I started walking down the street toward my metro stop. And honestly, the only thing in my head was, oh, please don't shoot me. Please don't shoot me. I made it to the end of the block, still alive, and got to the metro stop and I got my book from my friend and I'm walking back. And you know, it was so funny, Mary, because I had this bizarre experience of going from being really frightened of someone to suddenly feeling really sorry for him, because as I walked back, he's still there and he's sitting on the hood of this very shiny Mercedes that's got a smashed out window. And he really looks like a child who's just dreading the punishment that he knows is coming, because he didn't have anybody to drag back and blame it on. So he knew he was going to get the brunt of this. So as I came by in Russian, I said, you know, gosh, kind of looks like a bad day. And he said, oh, yes, this is a very bad day.
Yeah. How was he going to explain he hadn't been on watch?
Exactly. Yep.
He had stepped away at just the wrong moment. Oh, and I know that feeling of hoping somebody won't shoot you. I lived in Manhattan for a while and I did the reverse commute. I would take the subway up from the village where I lived and get out at Penn Station. And I created a little routine. I would get out, I would buy a cup of coffee, I would buy a newspaper, and then I would go in and get on my train and ride out to New Jersey. And so I'm sauntering up, no coffee yet, to get my coffee and newspaper. And as I'm coming up to the newspaper stand, my brain is saying, huh, gee, looks like that guy there is holding a pistol in his hand. Well, you know what? It is a pistol. Huh, you know, it's kind of a small one. I think it's a snub-nosed 38. And of course, by this time, just as my brain is starting to say, you are approaching a man with a gun in his hand, I realize I'm about, I don't know, 12, 18 inches away from him. Literally standing right next to him. And I'm not very tall and I've been concentrating on his hand and he's much taller than me. So I think, well, it's time to look up in his face and see if he knows that you know. And so I looked up at his face and he was looking intently into the crowd. So I said, okay, now is your time to walk away. Just walk around him and go over to the escalator and go down and walk normally. Don't run, and as I'm walking, I'm thinking, please don't shoot me. Please don't shoot me. That's going through my head. And I'll never forget telling these friends of mine about it. And they said, oh my goodness, I hear that when you get shot and killed, you never even know you got shot. And I thought, imagine that. I'm just walking and all of a sudden, I don't even know what happened to me. I don't even know the end of the story because I got shot and killed. So anyway, I did get on the escalator and I stayed standing still until I thought my head was below the ground level going down. And then I ran down the rest of the escalator, ran off. I knew where the police station was in Penn Station and ran into it and said, there's a man with a gun outside. And the policeman looks at me and says, oh, shit. That's so classic New York.
Yep.
But I am so glad you made it back and made it back to tell that story. And I can see that you live a charmed existence. You're in the middle of of an emergency.
You know, gotten lucky so far, touch wood. So
yeah. Well, good luck with helping Harris County with our current public health emergency. It's I'm sure challenging, and we all thank you for the work that you do.
I appreciate it, Mary.
So it's time now to come on back down to our home planet. Don't forget to check out our Facebook page, The Story Voice, and pass the word along about this great little podcast of ours. And y'all come back now. Before we sign off, thank you so much, Jerry Miller. And thank you to our subscribers for joining us for these out-of-world stories. It is always important to remember that it's not the destination, but the journey that's the best part of living. Peace.